what was happening in the nation of Israel there at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 4. The Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines. And so we end 1 Samuel chapter 4 with the birth of a baby named Ichabod, because the glory of God had departed from Israel. And so these first several chapters of Samuel are chapters of failure and of loss. We have the wickedness of Eli's sons. You have God taking the priesthood away from Eli and his lineage. And then you have the death of Eli's son, Hophni and Phinehas, and the death of Eli, and the capture of the Ark of the Covenant. And so this is a very dark time in the nation of Israel. And so we have now 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 1. It says, "Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice." So tragically, Samuel's sons are much like Eli's sons. They are not godly, faithful men, but they are self-seeking, you know, dishonest. You know, it says perverters of justice. And so you have, what, remind me again, what's going on in 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings? What's the big overarching, theme that we see that's interwoven through that? Yeah, man's failure. In this case, we're ultimately getting to the failure of the kings, but we have the failure of Israel, and particularly the leadership of Israel. If you want to say the book of Judges is about the failure of Israel as a nation, every man doing that which is right in his own eyes. And we come to Samuel's and Kings, and we have the leaders, the high priest, and his sons fail. Now we have Samuel, and he is a faithful judge and prophet, but his sons fail. And so that we find in these four books that there is that we cannot trust with any certainty upon the leadership to be righteous. Now, this is certainly not a call to anarchy, and it's not a call to despair, but rather, as Shannon's already said, it drives us to this need of a Savior. It shows that these men of Israel cannot do what most needs to be done. But we have here then in chapter 8, verse 4, "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'Look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations.'" So what's the point of comparison? In that verse, there's two of them, the comparison of Samuel and Samuel's sons, but there's another national comparison going on. What do they want a king to do? And I think implicit in their request is they're looking around at all these nations, say they have kings. We don't have a king, and here we are, we have lost, and we keep losing. And there's a victory there in the end of 1 Samuel 7. I just skimmed over. There's some amusing stories in chapters 5, 6, and 7 of the Ark of the Covenant while it's in the hands of the Philistines. We skimmed over all of that. So by the time we get to chapter 8, the Ark is kind of restored to Israel, but it's not with the tabernacle. But it's back in Israelite possession. They have had some victory over the Philistines, but they still, by and large, they are now an oppressed people. They are surrounded by enemies, and they are consistently losing. And there seems to be this fear that Samuel, who is now old, that once Samuel passes off the scene, things are going to go right back where they were, and they're going to be losing again and again and again. And so their solution was, give us a king. If we have a king, maybe we can be stable and victorious. Now, what's the biblical problem with that thinking? If you think in terms of the Mosaic covenant, the covenant that God made with Israel, what's the problem with thinking that a king is going to make them stable? They're not relying on God. And very specifically, God has told them, if you obey me, you will be victorious. If you disobey me, you will be cursed and you will suffer. And they're still failing to recognize that all of their defeats are directly related to their disobedience to God. That they have not kept the covenant, therefore they have lost. They have lost land, they've lost people, they've lost the things they treasure most. And so they're looking now to a king to do that, which a king can't do, because they're not doing what God has commanded them to do, therefore they're not receiving the promises God gave them. And so they're looking for some other way of getting what God has promised, and it doesn't work that way, as we will see over and over and over again in these four books. Verse 6, the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. And so you have Samuel going to God. He's upset, rightly so. And a crucial statement, as we all recognize, I think we all recognize as we go through this, that God tells Samuel, they're not rejecting you, Samuel. And this is not an indictment of Samuel's ministry. It's not a repudiation of Samuel as a prophet. But rather, they are rejecting whom? God. Just like they have done from the time they were brought out of Egypt. I mean, you remember in your mind all the times that they complained. Moses, you brought us out here to kill us. You brought us out here to starve us. You brought us out here to poison us. We're tired of manna. We want something else. So get to the borders of Canaan. We don't want to go in. We're all going to die. Why'd you bring us out here? We're going back to Egypt. And, you know, and over and over and over and over again. Then you get to the book of Judges. And we see that over and over and over again continuing. So for hundreds of years already, we have this pattern of Israel basically more or less walking in rebellion against God. And God says this is just one more step in that journey of their rebellion against me. But he says, do this. Give them the king, but also warn them. And basically the gist of the warnings are that if you establish king, he's going to tax you. He's going to make your children his slaves and his servants. He's going to go to war with them. You know, there's going to be suffering and oppression because you've asked for a king. And so we get down to verse 18. And it says, and you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. So it's a stern warning. They're going to come under this oppression of this king, and there's going to be times where the oppression of the king is going to be so terrible that they are going to cry out to God, seeking deliverance from their own king, not the king of an enemy nation, but their own king. And God is not going to hear them. He's giving them what they ask for as their judgment. And so this, and Samuel, as a faithful prophet, gives them the warning. This is a, if you will, is a final plea, this final opportunity for them to repent, to return to following the Lord. But verse 19, it says, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" So they say, "No, we want a king, and we want to be like all the nations around us." And I think we really do see the drive for victory. He's going to judge us. He's going to go before us. He's going to fight the battles there. He's going to lead us into victory. I think that's implied. I don't think anybody wants, we want a king that's a mediocre warrior. And we want a king, he's going to be a good, really good accountant. We don't care anything about battle. They wanted a king to go and to win warfare for them. But they wanted to be like who? What do they say there? They want to be like all the other nations. Put a bookmark there in 1 Samuel 9, because we're going to come right back. And go to Exodus 19. This is at Mount Sinai. This is the beginning of the entrance into the Mosaic Covenant. And God has not yet given them the law, any of that. But he is now beginning to formulate this covenant. And it's quite a process that they go through in creating this covenant together between Israel and God. But Exodus 19, verse 5, God tells Israel, "Now therefore, if you'll indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." And starting from that point, we can trace through the giving of the Mosaic Law, the repetition of this idea that they are a special treasure to God that is unique, a holy nation, separate and set apart from all the other nations of the world. So God called Israel out to distinguish them from all the other nations. He put them in the middle of the Middle East. They're in the crossroads of the world. And he gave them all of these laws that were really, as we recognize today, still many of them were quite strange. They were very different from the reactions and the worship of the nations around them. And God has already done and is going to continue to do some things in the nation of Israel that are absolutely remarkable. And that he's doing all of this so that Israel will be established as the showpiece of God. He's elevating Israel over all the nations of the world, distinguishing them from everyone else so that all the other nations can look at Israel and say, "Wow, look at their God. Look at how magnificent, how powerful, how glorious he is." We saw that last week. We read about the Philistines when they saw the Ark of the Covenant being brought out and into battle. They were terrified because they were still remembering what God had done in bringing Israel out of Egypt and then conquering the Canaanites. And now hundreds of years later, they're seeing the Ark of the Covenant come out. They imagine that is the idol to God, but they remember how God had worked, what God had done. They remembered the glory, the power of God. You go back to Rahab, and she has heard of what God has done in bringing Israel out of Egypt, conquering the peoples on the east side of the Jordan River. She's terrified. All of Jericho is terrified. Rahab believes, and she is saved. And because of the testimony of what God had been doing for the last 40 years through the people of Israel. So God has established Israel as a distinct nation this completely separate people that he has prescribed this massive body of laws to keep them distinct. In part, there's other things going on, but in part to keep them distinct. And now, go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. They go to God and they say, nope, make us a king because we want to be like everyone else. They have at this point in time said, we don't want anything to do with this distinction. We don't like it. It's not working out for us, however they might have been phrasing it. We want to be like the nations. And so they get a king. Samuel sends the men home. I'm just going to skim through the next couple chapters here, but where we have the selection and then the coronation of Saul as king. So I'm going to test your memories here. What do you remember about King Saul before he became king? How was he described? What kind of man was he? Where was he from? He was tall. Yeah, that's one of the distinguishing things is he was head and shoulders taller than everyone else in Israel. Yeah, there's a humility there. He, in fact, when they go to cast lots to identify who is going to be the king, they start with the tribes, they cast lots, they pick the tribe of Benjamin, they work their way down to the household of Kish, and now they're looking for the sons of Kish, and they say, "Where's Saul?" And he's hiding in the back with the luggage. And really, everybody else is there all gathered around. Saul's way back there. He's not interested in putting himself forward. And he's already, at that point in time, he's already been told he's going to be king. But there's a real humility there. And there really is. God later tells him, that he was humble. Says, "Before I anointed you, you were humble." And so there was a genuine humility in Saul at that time. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 12. Actually, start in chapter 10. I'm going to point you one thing real quick before we get to chapter 12. 1 Samuel 10 verse 17. It says, "Then Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah and said to the children of Israel, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all kingdoms and from those who oppressed you. But you have today rejected your God, who himself saved you from all your adversaries and your tribulations, and you have said to him, No, set a king over us. Now therefore present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans." And that's where they go through and they pick out Saul. But remind that God tells them again, what they are doing is a rejection of God. God who brought them out of Egypt. It wasn't a king who brought them out of Egypt. God who delivered them from their enemies. It wasn't a king who delivered them. It was God who did this. He's reminding them again of their rebellion and rejection against him. And then we get to chapter 12. And verse 12. He says, "And when you saw," this is Samuel speaking to Israel, and it's one of the more depressing coronation speeches ever. I'll let you read the whole thing on your own. But it's not the triumphant speech that you would expect at a coronation of a king. Verse 12, he says, "When you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us,' when the Lord your God was king." So there it is again. We see this theme repeated over and over and over again. They're acting in fear, looking for victory, and utterly rejecting God as their king. And so, verse 13, "Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. And take note, the Lord has set a king over you." And now what Samuel begins to do is teaches them the king is not going to give you victory, stability, and security. Rather, what is necessary if you would be a powerful, blessed nation is the same thing that has been necessary since the Mosaic covenant began. Obedience to God. That's the gist of what he's going to tell them. Let me read through it and then we'll work back and come back and work our way through it. Verse 14. If you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Lord your God. However, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandments of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. Now therefore, stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is today not the wheat harvest? I will call to the Lord and he will send thunder and rain that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord in asking a king for yourself. So Samuel called to the Lord and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. And all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God that we may not die. For we have added to all our sins the evil of asking a king for ourselves. Then Samuel said to the people, do not fear. You have done all this wickedness, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And do not turn aside, for then you would go after empty things which cannot profit or deliver, for they are nothing. For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you his people. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king. So, looking there in verses 16 and 17, what time of year was this? The wheat harvest, and there were several harvests at different times in the Middle East at that time. And so the wheat harvest was the particular time of year, time in the summer. And Samuel says, so that you'll know everything that I'm telling you is true, that what I'm saying is from God, something's going to happen. What was going to happen? Rain, thunder and rain specifically. So apparently a massive storm was going to come through. Anybody know why that's a big deal? Anybody want to make a guess on why that was a big deal? This was a time of, seasonally, it was a time of little to no rain. This was not the time you got thunderstorms. And that climate was very, very seasonal. And so to have a thunderstorm at this point, it'd be like us having a massive thunderstorm in January. It would be terrible, but it would be completely out of the ordinary. And that's what he's saying. This is something, this never happens. And now all of a sudden, out of the blue, comes this thunder and rain, and saying, showing, this is, and Samuel is speaking the words of God. But back to verse 14, he exhorts them to do three things. What's he tell them to do right off the opening phrase of verse 14? Fear the Lord, serve him, obey him. All, I would say, pretty much synonymous in this context. But he's saying, you know, keep the covenant. I'll keep going back to that. Obey the covenant of God. Do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord. And what he says, very interesting, the last phrase here, if you, he's speaking to the people, if you will continue to obey God and not rebel against him, then what will happen? If they are obedient, then both they and their king will continue in obedience. And what Samuel is doing, what God is telling Israel through Samuel, is that the righteousness of their king is directly related to the righteousness of the people. So that if they will follow the Lord, they will have a king who also follows the Lord. But if they do not follow the Lord, then their king will not follow the Lord. Now, in America, that kind of makes sense. You know, because we elect our officials. So if we're all wicked people, we're not going to elect righteous leaders. That's not the way the kingship works. We know how that works. It's somebody is anointed king, and then his son is king. And then his son is king. You know, it's a family dynasty, and the only way that that's changed is if somebody comes in and conquers the ruling family and establishes himself as king, which that happens quite a lot in other nations. It surprisingly did not happen a lot in Israel. You know, so you have here this dynasty saying, you know, but your king, this unelected official, you know, is going to be righteous or wicked based upon the righteousness or wickedness of the people. God is continuing, I think part of what's happening is God is saying, I'm going to continue to give you what you want. You want a king because you were in rejection and rebellion against me? I'm going to give you a king who lives in rejection and rebellion against me. But if you will pursue me, I will give you a king who will also follow after me. And then we get down to verse 20. And they see the thunder and lightning, they see the storm, and they cry out to Samuel, pray for us. We've done wrong. and so Samuel says, I will pray for you. I'm not going to stop praying for you. But he also says, verse 20, do not fear, do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. So it calls them to continued obedience. Verse 21, he says, do not turn aside. What would they pursue? What would they go after if they turn aside? Idols. Yeah. The New King James says empty things. The empty things here is specifically idols that cannot profit or deliver. Why can idols not give any benefit or any deliverance to anyone? What's he say there in that verse? They're nothing. They are nothing. They are figments. They are, and this is a fascinating theme to trace through the Old Testament, but you get to the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, and you see their treatments of idols. Jeremiah chapter 10 is a brutal, brutal takedown of idol worship. As it goes through and says, if somebody goes in the woods, cuts down a tree, cuts it up into logs. He puts most of them on the wood pile, burns them in the fireplace, cooks his food with them. He takes one piece, sends it to a carver. He carves it into an image. And because it cannot stay upright on its own, he fixes it to a base, secures it to something, and covers it over with precious metals, and then he picks it up and carries it home because it's powerless to go anywhere. And it has eyes and it cannot hear. Cannot see, and it has ears and it cannot hear. This deaf, dumb, powerless idol is now what you bow down and worship. I mean, and that's what he's saying in very brief. You go after idols, you go after the Baals and Ashtaroths of the Canaanites, you're going after those empty, worthless, powerless things. But verse 22, in contrast, the Lord will not forsake his people. Why? Why will he not forsake his people? What's verse 22 tell us? For his own great name's sake. He is going to show his glory. He is going to remain faithful to his covenant because he is God. He is not going to forsake his people. Because God has been pleased to make them his people. And then he says again in verse 24, only fear the Lord, serve him. Verse 25, if you still do wickedly, what will happen to them? They'll be swept away. Who? Who does he say will be swept away? Both you and your king. He's saying, if you disobey God, the king that you have asked for to give you victory, security in your land is going to be powerless to do so. And Samuel is driving them back to that same basic point that security for the Israelites is based entirely upon their keeping of the Mosaic covenant. Now, one thing I want to point out, and this is a little bit not yet revealed in the text, but I think we see the glimpses of it. We see God using this rebellion against him and this establishment of a king for his good purposes. So Israel is in utter rebellion against God. They have been told that repeatedly. They are warned again and again not to rebel against God. And yet God, as sovereign, is ruling in all of this to accomplish his good purposes. Now, because we know the rest of Israel's history, what good purposes was God accomplishing through the establishment of a king in Israel? Okay, King David. This man after God's own heart. Not this king, but the king after Saul. And so that through David, we see that Israel is given incredible victories. They are made relatively secure in the land. Through David's son, their security is established. And so that they reach their highest point of prosperity. And of even their largest magnitude in size as a nation under David's son Solomon. And so that we have this is moving really relatively swiftly into the peak of Israel's history. There was none other time before or after that was as prosperous and successful and it's under Solomon, peaceful as that era, those two men. And so we have that going on. There's something greater going on even there in the establishment of David as king. Yeah. So we now have God setting the stage for the son of David to come to reign over his people. We have now God using this rebellion of Israel as the means by which he is going to establish an eternal kingdom under an eternal king. And so we see, again, it's only, and really I think we see this only because we're looking backwards. I don't know that it is really there in the text. Particularly at this point in 1 Samuel, but we know looking backwards that God, we can see and trace the hand of God working even in Israel's rebellion to accomplish his good purposes, to establish eternal righteousness, to fulfill completely the Mosaic covenant. Part of what else is going on is this is, as we started off with, this is also going to show the absolute inability of Israel and the Israelites to keep the Mosaic covenant in any substantial degree. What we're going to see here is a king that fails. Saul fails miserably. We're going to see another king, David, established and live in righteousness, but even his glorious reign is tainted by sin. And then we see David's son start off gloriously and descend into the depths of folly. And then we see the division of the nation. So that after Solomon, you have 10 tribes that remain in absolute rebellion against God for the next 200 and something years until they're finally taken into captivity. After Solomon, you have the two tribes, the southern tribes, who rebel. More times than not, they rebel. There are moments of revival and we see some good kings in there. And yet even that those good kings, we find the corruptions in their reign. And you have all of this showing Israel. There's no hope in your king. There's no hope in having the right man on the throne. but rather hope has to be in God. And that's where, again, the prophets show us the promise of a Messiah who is the King, who establishes them in righteousness. And that, I mean, this all is essential, if you will, background for the new covenant. It's as we understand this that we see even better the promise, I will give them a new heart, I will make them my people, I will be their God, I will write my laws on their hearts, they will be, no one will have to teach his neighbor about God anymore because all will know me. Those glorious promises of absolute forgiveness, of permanent righteousness, of worldwide knowledge of God are rooted in the absolute failure of Israel and her kings. So we've got 5 minutes left. I'm very quickly I'm trying to bring this up, help us think through how then that applies to today. Because we're not Israel. We do not have, as Americans, we do not have a promise of God that if we will obey the Ten Commandments and live righteously, that we will have a prosperous nation. Now, we certainly have the principles in Proverbs, righteousness exalts a nation, sin is a reproach to any people. So if we live righteously, then you know, we would expect, typically, that there would be blessings in the nation. If we do what is right, if we're honest, we're humble, we are not, you know, living in greed, there's going to be positive benefits on our nation. You know, so I will agree with it to that extent. But we're not Israel. And so we can't claim the Mosaic covenant in any way as applicable to America. And certainly it's not a matter of if we elect the right person, then all of a sudden everything will be hunky-dory. That America will become a wonderful nation again and be just like it was in whatever idyllic time that you recall or look back on or think of from history. So what do we do with this? We're not Israel. We can't just bring it wholesale over here and say, if we obey God, he'll give us a righteous leader and everything will be wonderful. Well, we do with this part of what this, you know, what Samuel and the prophets do with it. We recognize that righteousness is never established in the nation by the rulers or by the efforts of individuals. We recognize that righteousness is established in a nation by the working and power of God. Yeah, this whole thing has shown us the utter failure of the chosen people of God. And there's really, honestly, there's no reason to think that we will ever do any better than Israel ever did. We are the same humanity that they are. But rather, righteousness is established by God. The other thing we can see from this is part of what we are looking at as we walk through Habakkuk as well, is God is working in all of these things to accomplish His perfect plan. I had a phone conversation with somebody yesterday that asked me where I saw things in America and how I thought things were going in America. And part of my answer to him was, I believe it's happening, everything in America is going exactly according to God's plan. God's in charge. He is bringing these things to the end that He intends. Now, do I understand how all these things are working in God's plan? No. There's a lot of things that are in the actions of our leaders and of individuals in our nation that are deeply troubling. I'm not minimizing sin in any way, but I also am not minimizing the sovereignty of God. I cannot. I have to look at whatever is going on in our nation and remember that God is sovereign. And just as he overruled the rebellion of Israel, so he overrules the rebellion of America to accomplish his perfect purposes. And so that we have to trust him. We have to rest in that utter sovereignty.